I am a very strong supporter of missile defense, but I think we need to put the money where we can actually get some value out of it.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates visits Fort Greely. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 2nd of June. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, recording the stories of tsunami survivors.
Hearing the story firsthand of someone who's faced a rare but hugely devastating phenomenon does capture the imagination.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The H1N1 swine flu has reached Alaska, and there are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water, or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands, and stay home if you're sick, and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
Congressional leaders are reflecting on their recent trip to China and a stopover in Anchorage, where they heard about climate change from Alaska Native leaders. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California led the group of four Democrats and one Republican, all members of the House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Speaker Pelosi says the May 22nd stop in Anchorage was a chance to hear firsthand from Alaskans about the effects of global warming. She talked about the trip at a press conference in the Capitol Tuesday afternoon.
We saw that if the polar cap is melting, the thermal control of the planet is affected. We saw leaders of villages whose villages were eroding and some melting into the sea. We heard about the damage to the flora and the fauna in Alaska. And, of course, the serious impact of melting of the permafrost and what that means in terms of methane gas. Just all to say that it is urgent that we address the issue of the global climate crisis.
Pelosi says they carried the message of what's happening in Alaska to China and discussed it with the Chinese.
China doesn't border the Arctic, but the glaciers are melting in the Himalayas. The Gobi Desert is expanding. They have sent storms in Beijing from the Gobi Desert. The sea level is rising, affecting the maritime areas of China. So they have every reason to be as motivated as anyone and as we are.
Pelosi says the stop in Alaska energized the delegation to talk about climate change. She and Congressman Ed Markey of Massachusetts, who heads the House Committee on Global Warming, both commented that seeing a part of the United States where climate change is altering the landscape had a dramatic impact on them. Some of the group traveled to Greenland a couple years ago to see melting ice shelves, but Markey says it's different hearing what's happening in his own country.
We were now visiting the United States of America. And this is a problem which is already manifesting itself in very dramatic ways in one of the states of the Union. And it only further reinforced the need for us to act and to act in a way that reflects the need for the world to have a treaty which begins to reduce these greenhouse gases.
Markey says the trip left him with a sense of urgency. He's pushing climate change legislation in Congress right now, focused on capping greenhouse gas emissions and setting up a carbon credit trading system. The lone Republican of the delegation, James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin, is his party's top member on the Global Warming Committee and does not support Markey's cap-and-trade legislation. In Anchorage, the group met with scientists from the University of Alaska and leaders representing Inupiat, Aleut, Yupik, Tlingit, and Athabascan communities. Stanley Tom traveled from the western Yupik village of Nutok. It's in the process of moving the entire village because the current location is below sea level and sinking, trapped by the widening Ninglik River. Tom showed the congressional delegation a PowerPoint presentation and photos of his village.
I talked about the climate change that's happening up in Alaska. We're one of the fastest eroding villages. I talked about the flooding, erosion, and sinking of the village, and it was a really good small meeting, and they were really impressed by how we are badly being impacted.
Stanley Tom says says it was the most influential group he's ever been able to talk to about what's happening in New Talk.
It was number one. You know, I really was happy that they came by. And, yes, those are very popular people down in Lower 48, and I see them in the news all the time. And I'm glad they stopped by to Anchorage and let them hear our problems here in Alaska.
Climate change is front and center in Washington right now because of the bill Markey is pushing, which is supported by the White House. There's also an international effort to get work done before the United Nations climate change talks in Copenhagen, Denmark in December. That's what inspired the congressional trip to China. While the delegation was there, they met with China's three top leaders, including the president and premier. In addition to talking about climate change, they also addressed North Korea's nuclear testing and missile launch, human rights, and intellectual property rights. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
North Korea is reportedly preparing an intercontinental missile for launch. The country has been blowing up explosives underground and launching short-range missiles for the past week, while at the same time preparing for ruler Kim Jong-il to be succeeded by his youngest son. That became official today. Analysts say North Korea could have as many as four intercontinental missiles. Yesterday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates took a look at an interceptor rocket based at Fort Greely and announced that the U.S. is ready for any missile threat from North Korea. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The tour included a simulated space battle conducted in a control room not far from the missile silos.
What you're seeing here is
three simulated intercontinental missiles come over the horizon, headed for Chicago, San Francisco, and Seattle. Simulated interceptors launched from Fort Greely and Vandenberg Air Force Base nailed them.
First threat in the air. Showing impact location of Chicago, Illinois. Recommend engage the threat in Chicago, Illinois.
Copy. Weapons engage Chicago with two GBIs, one Fort Greely, one Vandenberg.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates liked what he saw at Greeley.
You are, to a considerable extent, the prisoner of geometry, but I would say that if there were a launch from a rogue state such as North Korea, I have good confidence that we would be able to deal with it.
Both Gates and Senator Mark Begich went out into the windy Fort Greeley missile field itself, where one of the clamshell caps lay open, revealing the tip of an interceptor missile. They climbed down the rungs in a chamber next to it, where reporters were not allowed. When he came back out into the wind, Begich was clearly impressed.
How about that?
That was impressive. It's an incredible technology, and it's clearly shows we're ready for whatever comes upon us. But it's just a great technology down there, and just to have that explanation gives me, again, reassurance that we have the right defense system here.
It's right enough that the Obama administration budget does not discontinue the missile defense program, but it does trim it down. Gates has zeroed out one technology entirely, and he put a stop to a planned expansion of the Fort Greeley missile field to 44 silos. A total of 30 interceptors should be enough, at least for now, he said. He told reporters yesterday that he is still open to expansion in future years.
You know, my decision, my recommendation to the president was for the fiscal year 10 budget. It's not a forever decision, and if capabilities in one of these rogue states should develop faster or in a more worrisome way than anybody anticipates right now, then I think the way is open in the future to add to the number of silos and interceptors up here. But I think the view that the chairman and I had in putting the budget together was that as we look to the next few years, we think that the capability that we have here and in Vandenberg, the two sites together with 30 interceptors, it more than meets the need.
Senator Begich isn't saying how hard he's going to fight to get those 14 silos back. He says it's early in the budget process. Congress gets the final decision, and there are some in Congress who oppose the entire missile defense program. During his campaign, President Obama said the missile defense is good if it works. Gates says he and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff support it, but they want to see a lot more testing. Mark Begich reads that as encouraging, even with the holdup of construction of the new interceptor silo.
But along with that, the other piece that's very important for Alaska is the robust testing. You know, he talked about over $1 billion in research and testing. A portion of that will go to Kodiak launch site, because that's where a lot of testing and research is being done, along with other sites across the country. So this is, I think, a very positive sign.
Currently, there are 16 interceptors at Greeley. The proposed budget would continue adding missiles. Gates said he wants to concentrate on developing a better boost phase rocket and on testing. He said in some missile defense programs, the procurement process got ahead of the technology. Now it's time to be sure of what we have.
It doesn't mean we think any less of missile defense, as I've told the Congress. I am a very strong supporter of missile defense, but I think we need to put the money where we can actually get some value out of it.
It's unclear what the range of the new North Korean missile being prepared for launch will be. It's often speculated that it could reach at least the Aleutians and perhaps deeper into Alaska. At Fort Greeley, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, state lawmakers address the energy crisis in rural Alaska.
I hate to use the term paradigm shift, but that's exactly where Alaska has to go, and if it's bit by bit, we are going to change.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. The new AT&T, your world delivered. And by the Doyon family of companies, working together to build Alaska's future.
The cost of a natural gas line from the North Slope to North American markets has increased dramatically, while it has been a political issue for the past 30 years. And there's a good chance the federal government will recognize that by guaranteeing financing for more of the cost of the project. A provision in the National Energy Security Act currently before the Senate would increase the federal guarantees for development and construction loans from $18 billion to $30 billion. It was proposed in the original bill sponsored by North Dakota Democrat Byron Dorgan. The current $18 billion guarantee was established to cover 80% of the projected cost of the pipeline in 2004 when Congress approved it. However, Senator Mark Begich says those estimates are now too low.
This just, in my mind, inflation adjusted up to $30 billion, which is important to ensure that there's an option that the pipeline builders can utilize to construct the largest single project in the nation's history. So I think it's important that this be adjusted up to the $30 billion, absolutely.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says she believes a higher guarantee will be included in the final bill in some way, and she says it's more important to the project now than it was 5 years ago when the original guarantee was approved.
Natural gas prices this year have dropped precipitously, but what hasn't dropped are the operating costs, the construction costs. And so the imperative for a loan guarantee investment becomes even more meaningful with a project of this size and this scope.
The principal effect of a loan guarantee is to ease investors' concerns about lending money for the project, and Begich says with that, the financing and development costs will be lower.
And the net result is it saves the users, the people who will be, putting gas in their homes and heating up power plants and all those good things, a lower cost. And that's a good thing. And in my view, it is of national interest to do this gas line. So if we can increase that guarantee, which lowers the cost of interest, which then the consumers benefit with a lower price, that's a good thing.
There have already been some hearings on the energy bill in the Senate, but Begich says it is still in the early stages with several weeks of work left before it is ready. Murkowski says the committee will work on renewable electricity standards this week and will focus on the oil and gas provisions, including the loan guarantee, next Tuesday. The House Energy Committee held an official hearing in Bethel on Friday. 10 legislators listened to public testimony about the effects of the energy crisis in the lower Kuskokwim Delta. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
A standing room audience was on hand for the hearing. Local residents said they had never seen so many lawmakers in Bethel at once. During testimony, local leaders explained how fuel prices are deteriorating the quality of life for many residents. Gene Peltola is the president of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. He says many people in outlying villages simply don't have the resources to afford expensive air travel, even for health concerns.
They're staying back in their village because they don't have the necessary funds to travel unless it's absolutely necessary. Sometimes even they stay back in their village until it becomes a medical emergency and we have to medevac them into the regional hospital.
Like many other nonprofits, Peltola said fuel costs are eating away at the services his organization can provide. But the legislators were also in town to hear what was working. They took a Black Hawk helicopter to the village of Kasigluk for a tour of their wind turbines. At the hearing, Robert Nick said that wind is bringing down his costs. Nick lives in New Napachuk, where electricity is transmitted from those turbines with an intertie. He says before the intertie, he would spend about $300 a month on electricity, but not anymore.
Only once did I go over $100. My average has been about $80 to $90 a month, so that is a success story.
There was a consensus between lawmakers and those testifying that renewable energy was necessary to wean rural Alaska from its purely diesel diet. To illustrate the cost of that energy diet, Dennis Klein, a Bethel resident, compared the heat and electric bills from three homes he owns throughout the state. His Girdwood pad averaged $60 a month. Eagle River ran him about $200 a month, but his Bethel home blows those figures away.
In Bethel, the month of January, I paid $2,100 for electricity, propane, and oil.
And that bill was actually reduced with some assistance from the state-funded PCE program. Power cost equalization subsidizes a portion of electric bills for rural customers. PCE has grown to over $38 million in the latest capital budget. But Energy Co-Chair Representative Charisse Millett of Anchorage said that the PCE program is not the final solution.
It's not an energy plan per se, but it's a Band-Aid. And, you know, we know you don't want to be on PCE. And Urban Alaska doesn't want you to be on PCE. And I think that's, you know, what we're trying to accomplish here.
Several leaders said that part of the solution was reducing energy costs, and they criticized Governor Sarah Palin's decision to reject over $28 million in federal money designated for energy-efficient building. Myron Nanning is the president of the Association of Village Council Presidents, representing 56 Native villages.
Living in Alaska, I can't see how she could ever reject that. And for many of our people that need energy relief, that's something that should have been accepted without any questions.
The AVCP Housing Authority used state funds to weatherize over 100 homes last year, and they plan on doing more than that this year. Robert Nick is the chairman of the Housing Board. He says more money would help them reach more homes, and he disagreed with the governor's assertions that the funds would have required more stringent building regulations.
All 14 housing authorities in the state of Alaska are already mandated to comply with Alaska Building Energy Efficiency Standards.
Some called on the legislature to override the governor's decision or support a move to redirect those funds into regional housing authorities. The village of Kuislik called on the legislature to revise laws governing economic emergencies. Much like the village of Emonik, Kuislik was caught with empty fuel tanks last year when the river froze early, but neither village received emergency assistance. George Guy is the administrator for Kuislik Incorporated.
The policies and procedures from the state of Alaska needs to change to adhere to energy emergencies in rural Alaska.
Other possible solutions included a hydroelectric plant operating in the Kuskokwim River system and even building homes partially underground. The hearing lasted about 4.5 hours. At its conclusion, Energy Co-Chair Representative Bryce Edgman of Dillingham said all ideas are on the table.
I hate to use the term paradigm shift, but that's exactly where Alaska has to go, and if it's bit by bit, we are going to change.
The Energy Committee will move on to Fairbanks for a hearing on June 17th. Later, they'll travel to the communities of Kenai, Dutch Harbor, Ketchikan, and Anchorage. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Operating a forklift is serious business, and operators are required to be properly trained and certified. The emotional and financial damage can be severe when a family member never comes home from work or comes home with a debilitating injury due to a forklift accident. Training information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
The state is scaling back its response to the big wildfire burning near McGrath. The over 25,000-acre broken snowshoe fire has slowed with clouds and high humidity in the western interior. State Fire Information Officer Andy Alexandru says that's enabled fire crews to make good progress in recent days along the fire's edge near McGrath.
36% of the fire line is now contained, and that's along the Kuskokwim River from the east going to the west past McGrath and along the Kakotna drainage. That's about 14, 15 miles of fire perimeter. The crews are doing mop-up on that section of line now, going in 300 feet, making sure the fire is completely out.
Alexandru says the number of crews on the fire will be reduced from 13 to 4 by the end of the week if the weather continues to be cloudy and wet. He says the decision to demobilize staff also reflects economic factors.
Today, costs have been $1.7 million, and the powers to be are looking at reducing the cost. The fire risk has diminished somewhat also, so it's a combination of common sense and dollars.
Alexandru says the fire will remain somewhat active for the rest of the summer and could flare back up when the weather dries out. Tsunami survivors across Alaska are telling their stories this week for archiving at the Pacific Tsunami Museum in Hawaii. Jeannie Johnston and Dr. Walter Dudley are co-founders of the museum. They're interviewing more than 25 people who lived through the 1964 Good Friday tsunami in Seward, Valdez, and Cordova. In September, they'll also record stories in Kodiak. Johnston is a survivor of the devastating 1946 tsunami that killed 159 people in Hawaii, most of them in her hometown of Hilo. No one in Johnston's family died, but she has vivid memories of the event, even though she was a young girl at the time. The tsunami originated near Alaska.
The earthquake was centered right near Scotch Cap that created the tsunami that took out the lighthouse and cost five lives of the Coast Guard men that were there. And then 4 hours and 20 minutes, it hit Hawaii.
So how devastated was the town?
The area that we were in, the first thing that happened was the road was taken out, and so we had no means of escape. And personally, our family house was picked up its foundations and put back in the backyard. And it started the day as a three-story house and ended as a two-story house in the backyard.
Do you remember do you remember how you felt? Do you remember what your grandparents did? Do you remember how you got away? Tell us about that.
Well, it was about 7 o'clock in the morning, and I was 6 years old, and my four-year-old brother also was there. And I went out to the front porch, and I saw this commotion, and noticed there was water and debris in the yard. So I went and gathered up my brother, and he and I walked out the driveway to the mailbox, and we were standing by the mailbox, kind of wondering what was going on, when these red ants started biting my brother's feet, and he started whining and carrying on and wanted to go back in the house. So we left and went back in the house, and it was those red ants that saved our lives that day, because once we got into the house, I told my grandmother there was water in the yard, and I looked out the back window, and the second wave had come, and by that time, there was 5 feet of water in the backyard. So she, without looking, said to me, "Oh, don't worry about it, it's just high seas." And then she looked out the window, started screaming, and ran for my grandfather. And the adults seemed to know what to do. They knew that we needed to evacuate the house. But my grandfather refused to leave the house, and my grandmother wouldn't leave without my grandfather. So my uncle took my brother and I, after the second wave receded, out to the highway, it was just a road, And he gave us to this other family that was evacuating. And we went with them, and we went down two houses and then went back into the jungle. Somebody had a machete, and they chopped through the jungle. As we left, though, we saw the water coming. We saw a wall of water coming at us, and it would just look like a white wall of water.
So this was all in 1946. So let's go back to 1964, which is you're looking for survivors who remember that.
Well, we went to save the stories for several reasons. We saved them for research purposes, and we saved them for historical purposes. But most importantly, we used them for education. One of the things we found is that because tsunamis are so rare, that's not on the top of the list of things that people, as far as mitigation goes. And so it's hard to get the message out. People aren't really interested. It won't happen to me. It won't happen here, and that sort of thing. So we use these stories, and they captivate people's interest. They're very powerful stories. And once you have these stories, you can use them to give the message of preparedness.
Why are people fascinated with this? Is it the thought of survival? Is it the thought of the just horrifying power of the ocean that we really have no idea how to control or what?
Well, you know, Rudyard Kipling quite famously said that if history were taught as stories, it would never be forgotten. And I think hearing the story firsthand of someone who's faced a rare but hugely devastating phenomenon does capture the imagination. And we hope to deliver with these stories an unforgettable message of tsunami preparedness.
I've never, of course, seen one. I hope never to.
but, you know, we probably will. It's been... what now, how many years since 1964? That was the last Pacific-wide tsunami.
45 years.
And the longest period in recorded history is, I believe, 46 years, between 1877 and 1923. So we're going to be setting a record, and it'll probably be broken because another tsunami will come.
Walter Dudley and Jeannie Johnston are co-founders of the Pacific Tsunami Museum. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Fort Greeley. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Susanna Caldwell, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.